Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and stories from around the world is designed for people learning English. So, we speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. Today, we have reports from Mario Ritter, Kelly Jean Kelly, and Ashley Thompson. Later, we hear from Alice Bryant, who brings us the program Ask a Teacher. And we close the show with an American story. Today, we continue with William Wilson by Edgar Allan Poe. But first, this report from Susan Shand.
Jamal Khashoggi is one of the most influential Arab journalists in the world. No one has seen or heard from him since October 2nd. That was the day he walked into Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul. Turkish government officials have said he was killed inside the office. Saudi Arabian officials deny harming the journalist. Jamal Khashoggi has worked for Saudi, American, and international publications. He is highly critical of the government of Saudi Arabia, the nation of his birth. Khashoggi lived in the United States after fleeing Saudi Arabia in June 2017. When asked why he left, he told Al Jazeera Television in March, "I don't want to be arrested." Jamal Khashoggi was born 59 years ago in Medina, Saudi Arabia. He comes from a wealthy and powerful family. He is the grandson of Muhammad Khashoggi, a Turk who served as the personal doctor for King Abdulaziz Al Saud, the founder of Saudi Arabia. Jamal Khashoggi is a nephew of Adnan Khashoggi, a Saudi businessman who was involved in an arms-for-hostage deal, the Iran-Contra scandal. In the 1980s, Adnan Khashoggi was reported to be worth $4 billion. After completing his studies at Indiana State University in 1983, Jamal Khashoggi began working as a reporter for the English language newspaper Saudi Gazette. In the 1990s, he reported from Afghanistan, Algeria, Sudan, and the Middle East. He later wrote for other English and Arab language newspapers. He rose to become deputy editor-in-chief of Arab News, the top English newspaper in Saudi Arabia. In his reporting and opinion pieces, Khashoggi often criticized Saudi religious values and pushed the government to carry out reforms. He made an enemy of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the first deputy prime minister of Saudi Arabia and son of King Salman. In 2017, Saudi police arrested nearly 50 political and business leaders in what critics saw as a power move by the Crown Prince. The action was quickly followed by the arrest of 17 women's rights activists, Israel Gom Gom and her husband. Fearing for his safety, Khashoggi fled to the United States, where he lived outside Washington, D.C. "I have left my home, my family, and my job, and I am raising my voice. We Saudis deserve better," he wrote in his first guest column for the Washington Post. Khashoggi entered the Saudi diplomatic office in Istanbul to complete paperwork he needed to get remarried. His wife-to-be, a 36-year-old Turkish woman, said she stood 11 hours near the door to the consulate, waiting for him to return. When he did not appear, she reported his disappearance. I'm Susan Shand.
Pope Francis has accepted the resignation of Cardinal Donald Wuerl. The Archbishop of Washington was recently named in a report accusing church leaders of covering up sexual abuse. Wuerl's predecessor, Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, was forced to resign in late July. He had been accused of sexually abusing several people, including children. A Vatican statement Friday said Pope Francis had accepted Wuerl's resignation, but named no replacement. The letter said Wuerl made some mistakes in dealing with sex abuse cases. However, the letter said, Wuerl was not accused of trying to hide them. The Pope asked Wuerl to stay on until a new archbishop is named. Wuerl's office released a statement saying, "Once again, for any past errors in judgment, I apologize and ask for pardon. My resignation is one way to express my great and abiding love for you, the people of the Church of Washington." In August, the state of Pennsylvania released a grand jury report connected to abuse in the Catholic Church. The report accused Wuerl of helping to protect some priests who had sexually abused children in Pittsburgh from 1988 to 2006. Wuerl was bishop of Pittsburgh at the time. The report said he permitted priests accused of wrongdoing to be moved or reinstated. Critics questioned Wuerl over his claim of not knowing about alleged sexual wrongdoing by McCarrick. Catholic League President Bill Donahue, however, defended the cardinal. He told the Associated Press, "No bishop or cardinal in the nation has had a more consistent and courageous record than Donald Wuerl in dealing with sex abuse by priests." David Cloese is with the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP. He said Wuerl's resignation is long overdue, but he said it would likely do little to stop other clergy from covering up for abusers. I'm Ashley Thompson.
There is a small but growing movement in America of households that want to reduce waste to zero. Their goal of producing no trash is probably impossible to reach. Some come close, reducing a year's worth of trash to only a few things that can fit into a small container. All other things, they say, can be recycled or composted. Zero wasters, as they are called, help each other by sharing advice on blogs and social media. A number of people also have written recent books on the subject. Some of the advice includes where to buy things to avoid unwanted packaging and where to recycle things that most people throw away.
Bea Johnson is author of Zero Waste Home, The Ultimate Guide to Simplifying Your Life by Reducing Your Waste. She said, "It may be too extreme for a lot of people, but even if you can cut your trash down by even 20%, you'll gain 80% of the benefits, like saving time and money for experiences instead of shopping for unnecessary stuff." She added, "It's about a simpler life based on being, not having." Johnson said that reducing shopping means her family has more money for fun vacations. She said her family buys recycled things also. All their clothing, for example, comes from used clothing stores. She says that has reduced her household spending by 40%. "We can get most brands on eBay and request that they be sent to us without any non-recyclable packaging," she said. Johnson has been writing about zero waste efforts since 2008.
Elizabeth Graves is the editor-in-chief of Martha Stewart Living magazine. She says she considers zero waste a movement. Graves said the millennial generation is very concerned about how they live. She adds, "More and more people are showing that while it's intimidating at first, it can be done." Graves Magazine recently reported on Lauren Singer of New York City. Singer started her own blog, Trash is for Tossers. She gives advice about how to reduce waste and where to buy goods that have little or no packaging. Singer said that she can fit 6 years of her trash into a single mason jar. "I realized that I can make a huge difference even as one individual," she said. "It's empowering." Zero wasters like to talk about 5 R's that describe what they do: refuse, reduce, reuse, recycle, and rot. The first R stands for refuse. They refuse containers and straws at restaurants. To this end, they either ask to use their own containers or request that things like food be wrapped in paper. Zero wasters also seek to reduce the number of things they buy. They reuse household goods and recycle materials. They also try to compost or rot food material that can be used to enrich soil.
I'm Mario Ritter.
And I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Believe it or not, the English language has about 25,000 idiomatic expressions. And some of the oldest ones have very interesting histories. Today, our question involves an expression from early English literature. It comes from Dimitri in Serbia. Here is what he writes.
What is the exact meaning of the word doornail? That word comes from Shakespeare's idiom, as dead as a doornail. I'm not sure about what the idiom means and when it is used.
Hello, Dmitry. That is a great question. One of the best things about teaching is that students ask questions teachers don't know the answers to. We have to look for the information, and in the process, we learn things too. Here is what I learned. The expression "as dead as a doornail" is older than William Shakespeare. One of its earliest known uses was in a poem by the 14th century English writer William Langland. Knowing the meaning of doornail will help us understand this idiom. Doornails are very large nails that, in early times, were used to strengthen doors. Workers hit the nails into doors, and the sharp end came out on the other side. The worker then flattened the sharp metal with a hammer to make each nail secure. There are two theories about why doornails were called dead. One says that after they were repeatedly hit, the nails became unusable for any other purpose. Another says that the force and number of times these nails were hit killed them, making them dead. Whichever explanation is true, as dead as a doornail simply means this: totally and completely dead. The expression was common in England by the 16th century. Shakespeare used it in some of his works, including in Henry IX, Part II. Today, the expression is not often heard, especially in American English. But making comparisons of equality with the word "as" is still common in American English. One way we do this is with the structure "as" plus adjective plus "as." For example,
I am as tall as my father.
Here's another example.
Your food is as good as it was years ago.
When we use the "as" plus adjective plus "as" structure in expressions, we call them similes. Here is an example of a commonly used simile.
As light as a feather.
Here's another example.
As happy as a clam.
And sometimes similes involve humor, such as exciting as watching paint dry, which means not exciting at all. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Alice Bryant.
Now it is time for our program, American Stories. Today we hear part two of William Wilson by Edgar Allan Poe.
In the first part of my story, I spoke about my life at my first school and about the other boys, over whom I gained firm control. But there was one boy who would not follow my commands, who would not do what I told him to, as the other boys did. His name was the same as mine, William Wilson. Although he did not belong to my family in any way, he seemed to feel some love for me, and had entered the school the same day as I had. Many of the boys thought we were brothers. I soon discovered that we had been born on the same day, January 19th, 1809. Wilson continued his attempts to command me, while I continued my attempts to rule him. The strange thing is that although I did not like him, I could not hate him. We had a battle nearly every day, it is true. In public it would seem that I had been proved the stronger. But he seemed somehow able to make me feel that this was not true, and that he himself was stronger. Nevertheless, we continued to talk to each other in a more or less friendly way. On a number of subjects we agreed very well. I sometimes thought that if we had met at another time and place, we might have become friends. It is not easy to explain my real feelings toward him. There was no love, and there was no fear, yet I saw something to honor in him, and I wanted to learn more about him. Anyone experienced in human nature will not need to be told that Wilson and I were always together. This strange appearance of friendship, although we were not friends, caused no doubt the strangeness of battle between us. I tried to make the others laugh at him. I tried to give him pain while seeming to play a light-hearted game. My attempts were not always successful, even though my plans were well made. There was much about his character that simply could not be laughed at. I could find, indeed, but one weakness. Perhaps he had been born with it, or perhaps it had come from some illness. No one but me would have made any use of it against him. He was able to speak only in a very, very soft, low voice. This weakness I never failed to use in any way that was in my power. Wilson could fight back, and he did. There was one way he had of troubling me beyond measure. I had never liked my name. Too many other people had the same name. I would rather have had a name that was not so often heard. The word sickened me. When on the day I arrived at the school, a second William Wilson came also, I felt angry with him for having the name. I knew I would have to hear the name each day a double number of times. The other William Wilson would always be near. The other boys often thought that my actions and my belongings were his, and his were mine. My anger grew stronger with every happening that showed that William Wilson and I were alike in body or in mind. I had not then discovered the surprising fact that we were of the same age, but I saw that we were of the same height, and I saw that in form and in face we were also much the same. Nothing could trouble me more deeply, although I carefully tried to keep everyone from seeing it, than to hear anyone say anything about the likeness between us of mind or of body or of anything else. But in truth I had no reason to believe that this likeness was ever noticed by our schoolfellows. He saw it, and as clearly as I, that I knew well. He discovered that in this likeness he could always find a way of troubling me. This proved the more than usual sharpness of his mind. His method, which was to increase the likeness between us, lay both in words and in actions, and he followed his plan very well indeed. It was easy enough to have clothes like mine. He easily learned to walk and move as I did. His voice, of course, could not be as loud as mine, but he made his manner of speaking the same. How greatly this most careful picture of myself troubled me, I will not now attempt to tell. It seemed that I was the only one who noticed it. I was the only one who saw Wilson's strange and knowing smiles, pleased with having produced in my heart the desired result. He seemed to laugh within himself and cared nothing that no one laughed with him. I've already spoken of how he seemed to think he was better and wiser than I. He would try to guide me. He would often try to stop me from doing things I had planned. He would tell me what I should and should not do, and he would do this not openly, but in a word or two in which I had to look for the meaning. As I grew older, I wanted less and less to listen to him. As it was, I could not be happy under his eyes that always watched me. Every day I showed more and more openly that I did not want to listen to anything he told me. I have said that in the first years when we were in school together, my feelings might easily have been turned to friendship. But in the later months, although he talked to me less often then, I almost hated him. Yet let me be fair to him. I can remember no time when what he told me was not wiser than would be expected from one of his years. His sense of what was good or bad was sharper than my own. I might today be a better and happier man if I had more often done what he said. It was about the same period, if I remember rightly, that by chance he acted more openly than usual, and I discovered in his manner something that deeply interested me. Somehow he brought to mind pictures of my earliest years. I remembered, it seemed, things I could not have remembered. These pictures were wild, half-lighted, and not clear, but I felt that very long ago I must have known this person standing before me. This idea, however, passed as quickly as it had come. It was on this same day that I had my last meeting at the school with this other strange William Wilson. That night, when everyone was sleeping, I got out of bed, and with a light in my hand, I went quietly through the house to Wilson's room. I had long been thinking of another of those plans to hurt him, with which I had until then had little success. It was my purpose now to begin to act according to this new plan. Having reached his room, I entered without a sound. Leaving the light outside, I advanced a step and listened. He was asleep. I turned and took the light and again went to the bed. I looked down upon his face. The coldness of ice filled my whole body. My knees trembled. My whole spirit was filled with horror. I moved the light nearer to his face. Was this the face of William Wilson? I saw, indeed, that it was. But I trembled as if with sickness as I imagined that it was not. What was there in his face to trouble me so? I looked and my mind seemed to turn in circles in the rush of my thoughts. It was not like this, surely not like this, that he appeared in the daytime. The same name, the same body, the same day that we came to school. And then there was his use of my way of walking, my manner of speaking. Was it in truth humanly possible that what I now saw was the result, and the result only, of his continued efforts to be like me? Filled with wonder and fear, cold and trembling, I put out the light. In the quiet darkness, I went from his room, and without waiting 1 minute, I left that old school and never entered it again.
And that is our show for today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.